Tales from the Archives. Who Killed Pile? Volume 1. Written by Shara Spencer. Narration by Diara Springer. Produced by Adrian Boeing.
Hi, lovey. Have you ever parked out? Don't be coy now. You know what I mean. Cozied up with a paramour in a romantic, mostly secluded spot in a car. I guess a truck will also do, to spend a little quality time chatting. Wink, wink. Yes, yes, you two may have been in love, or in some cases, unbridled lust. But did you ever consider the precarious situation you could have been in? Let's take away the romance for a moment. No. You find yourself in a dark, secluded spot with no witnesses, where no one can hear you scream. You see, this is exactly the kind of thing that found sweet boy Pele in a pickle. He got into his alleged girlfriend's car and headed to a lover's lane spot in Atlantic Shores. But somehow, he ended up with a fatal gunshot wound, a rock in the back seat of the car, a bloody shirt that wasn't his, and a lot of unanswered questions. Who killed Victor Pele Paris? Was it a crime of opportunity and just downright bad luck? Did the girlfriend do it? Or was it some masked man like she claimed? Was the motive something he did? Or was the shooter linked to her? Was it just a random act of violence? Or a well-calculated plot filled with intrigue, politics, jilted lovers, and cover-ups? Truth be told, we may never know exactly what happened on the night of May 16th, 1978. But that shouldn't stop us from trying. You know how I like to research. So let me do some digging and see if we can find out who really killed Pele. By all accounts, Pele was an amazing guy. Everybody loved him. He was friendly, popular, and an all-round good fella. He helped out friends, neighbors, pretty much everybody. And not only was he nice, but he was genuinely a pillar in the community. He was involved in the Regent Hill Youth and Cultural Group, Combermere Old Scholars Association, Matt Hill Sports Club, St. Barnabas Sports Club, and Haggett Hall Sports Club, to mention a few. He was also a Sunday school teacher and active in St. Barnabas Church. At one point, he was a teacher at an academy. Remember this for later. And he even acted as headmaster for about a year. So no one, absolutely no one, expected Pele to be shot and killed in a mystery that up to this day has not been officially solved. So what happened, you ask? Well, it all started with a girl. To use Bajan parlance, Pele was a saga boy. He was a good-looking guy, energetic, loved sports, partying, and generally having a good time. He was a charmer, an ooze charisma which, as you could imagine, drew people, women, to him. According to his dad, Pele had a varied love life, but suffice to say, he was popular with the ladies. Enter the bank chick. Pele didn't normally tell his dad much about his dalliances, but he gushed about his new girlfriend who worked at the bank. According to Papa Pele, it was about 3 to 4 months that the two of them were seeing each other, and on more than one occasion, Pele told his dad that he really liked her. Here's what Dad had to say.
He had no car of his own, so I would take him to work on mornings, and she would bring him back home at night. It might sound strange, but I never got a chance to meet her. And in fact, the first time I saw her was in court during the hearing. I remember one night after she dropped him home, He came into the house and found me still up and told me, if I knew you were still awake, I would have introduced you to my girlfriend.
Seeing that Pele was clearly smitten with his new girl, you can imagine that he confided in someone. But that someone was his self-appointed adopted mother, Mama Ed. He would call her every day and tell her about his bank check. He boasted that his new girl love was from St. George, that her family had a lot of property, and that he had, quote unquote, gone into a lot of money. Mama A would later share that Pele confided in her, and she had got the impression he loved the bank chick very much.
Well, he said that she was going to the States in August, and she was saying for him and marry him.
But poor Pele never heard any wedding bells. Because when his father dropped him off at work on the morning of May 16th, he never returned home. On that fateful night, the lone surviving victim, Bank Chick, ran screaming from the crime scene, clad only in a blouse and panty. She flied down the car of two unsuspecting strangers. Let's call them Good Samaritan, the driver, and his friend, the passenger. And she begged them to help her, which they did. And here's where it starts to get a little odd. Good Samaritan and his friend were going about their business when, out of nowhere, a half-naked woman jumped out in front of them. That would startle even the most kind-hearted person. So Good Samaritan put the car in reverse and was ready to get out of there. However, the half-naked woman, Bank Chick, pleaded with them and told them that a man had just been shot and the shooter was trying to rape her. Good Samaritan told her to get into the car and they drove away. Bank Chick explained that she and her boyfriend Pele had gone into the area to look at some land. Now, this was about 8 o'clock in the night, but okay. While they were sitting in the car talking, a man came up and tried to have sex with her. Her boyfriend, like any good boyfriend, tried to prevent the stranger's assault, and the would-be rapist, so aggrieved that Pele wouldn't let him rape Bank Chick, shot Pele in the arm. Good Samaritan was not about to stick around for any rapist-turned-murderer to come back. Although, Bank Chick pleaded with him to return to the scene of the crime and help Pele. She also mentioned that all of her things were back there and she wanted to get them. Which seems a little callous, but maybe her handbag was very important. Anyhow, Good Samaritan wholeheartedly decided that he had done his good deed for the day and he was not going anywhere near that area. However, like any responsible person, he told Bank Chick that he would take her to the police station. Sounds like a plan, right? Wrong. Bank Chick was not having it. She didn't want to go to the police station half naked because, as she put it, her dad was a police officer, and as she turned up there dressed as she was, he would kill her. Figuratively, of course. Now, if my daughter had escaped a would-be rapist, I'd be so grateful that she was alive and unharmed. I wouldn't have cared if she turned up butt naked. But different strokes for different folks. Anyhow, Bank Chick decided that Good Samaritan should drop her at a friend's house nearby and she would call the police from there. This was fine by Good Samaritan, as he was probably regretting every turn he took that night that put Bank Chick in his path and was more than happy to get her out of his car. He didn't even wait to see if she got into the friend's house okay. He dropped her off and was gone. Can't say blame the guy. It's interesting though how his friend described Bank Chick.
She had a scared look on her face, but was not crying, and the blouse she was wearing appeared normal, and not like if somebody was trying to tear it from her body.
Curious that she would say that of all those things, don't you think? But I digress. Bank Chick got to her friend's house, or more accurately, a couple that knew her parents, and they let her in. You think that a half-naked young woman who narrowly escaped a rape and most likely witnessed a murder would have elicited immediate action. However, Mr. Family Friend said that after hearing Bank Chick's story, he continued eating his dinner. He decided to go with her to the scene of the shooting when he was finished and had changed his clothes. Mrs. Family Friend was also unbothered and later told the commission that although it seemed to her that Bank Chick was in serious trouble, she continued to watch television. This sounded so unbelievable that at the commission, almost 2 years later, the commissioner legit called her out. Here's the report.
Are you asking us seriously to believe that?
Mr. Commissioner asked.
I said I continued to watch television.
Mrs. Family Friend repeated.
And what was I supposed to do?
But what was even more curious? Mr. Family Friend admitted that although Bank Chick called his name and he let her into the house, he didn't recognize her until 30 minutes later when she mentioned Helle's name. So we are to believe that he let a half-naked woman into his house that he didn't know? Okay. On the other hand, Mrs. Family Frank claimed that while she immediately knew who Bank Chick was, she had no idea why the girl had visited her house that night.
She made no mention of assistance or medical attention for the man.
Mrs. Family Friend stated, she did not notice that Bank Chick's hair was disorderly and her blouse was dirty on the lower front. The commission was curious to find out what Mrs. Family Friend had seen that prompted her to say the blouse was dirty. So like any good inquisitor, they asked her if she meant dirt from the earth. To that, Mrs. Family Friend was rather curt and replied,
dirty.
On further prompting, she described it as mud, but relented and agreed there were blood stains on Bank Chick's blouse. Despite the laissez-faire attitude of the two, it seems someone in the house not only washed, but also ironed Bank Chick's dirty, possibly bloody, blouse. By now, you think that somebody had called the police or an ambulance or something, and you'd once again be wrong. When giving his testimony at the commission, Mr. Family Friend stated that he called the police before he went to the scene the first time. No, you didn't mishear that. He and Bank Chick went to the crime scene twice that night. However, he did not actually call the police then, but much later. From what I could piece together, he borrowed his wife's red Toyota MC613 and went to the crime scene. He noted that the crime scene was too dark, so he didn't get out and didn't allow Bank Chick to get out either. At this point, he probably realized that this situation was more than he could handle. And seeing there was an alleged murderous rapist on the loose, he went to get a friend. So he drove over to the house of an acquaintance who lived nearby. The friend, let's call him Jay, was surprised to see Mr. Family Friend and Bank Chick, who, although having washed and ironed her blouse, was still clad in a panty. That seems a bit suspicious if you ask me, but more on that later. So Mr. Family Friend went to get assistance from Jay, who had a companion with him at the time. And like the two responsible people they were, Jay and his lady friend suggested that they call the ambulance, but were told that Pele was already dead. Pele was most assuredly not dead yet. Jay's lady friend was pretty disturbed by the sight of Mr. Family Friend and Bank Chick, who, although freshly bathed and with an iron shirt, was still wearing a panty. Odd, to say the least. Lady Friend was, as she put it, terrified, because she felt the two were intruders who were trying to use a sad story to get into the house for nefarious purposes. Lady Friend explained that she was sitting in the kitchen when she first heard a car stop, and later saw a man walking slowly up the driveway. The man, whom she did not know, asked for the boss of the house. And then a woman appeared and said she wanted to talk to somebody and wanted to know what she should tell the police. Here's what Lady Friend told the commission.
What they were saying and how they were behaving did not coincide. She, Bank Chick, was explaining but not hysterical. Mr. Family Friend was very calm. I didn't get the impression this was a woman whose friend had just been shot.
Explain that Bank Chick surely looked freshly bathed and didn't look like someone who escaped a murderous would-be rapist. Lady Friend told the commission that she had offered to call an ambulance for the man who was supposedly shot and left dying in the road. But Bank Chick replied that the man was already dead. Again, Pele was not dead yet. So it would seem that Mr. Family Friend, with Bank Chick in tow, left Jay's house and went back to his own home, where he called the police, finally. The police station was approximately 6 minutes away, so they got there in no time. Whether Mr. Family Friend met the police at his house, on the main road, or on another road, it's not exactly clear. But somehow, he led the officers to the crime scene. Let's pause one moment and remember that Bank Chick's dad was a retired police officer. Therefore, it would be reasonable to assume that some of the policemen would know Bank Chick and would consider her an upstanding citizen like her dad. This seemed to be the thinking of the first policeman on the scene. Mr. Policeman said he had accepted everything Bank Chick had first told him because he knew her very well and that, quote, she was a friend and not a stranger. At least in Mr. Policeman's mind, friends didn't tell their friends lies. In his mind, his friend Bank Chick was, of course, innocent. That being said, he didn't feel the need to answer if she had shot Pele or if she knew who shot him. Nor did he feel the need to take any notes of their first conversation. When asked about the scene when he arrived, Mr. Policeman noted that he saw the car with the four doors open facing the direction of town. Pele was on the back seat with half his body inside the car and from the waist down protruding through the back door on the driver's side. His shoes were outside the car and he was naked from the waist up, with two shirts piled up on the car's back seat. In case you forgot, at this time, although Bank Chick had told Jay and his lady friend that Pele was dead, he surely was still alive at this point. Anyways, someone finally realized that poor Pele was still alive, and he was rushed via police car to the hospital by Mr. Policeman and his constable. At this point, Bank Chick retrieved her skirt and handbag from the car. Clearly, the whole protecting the integrity of the crime scene thing was not in anyone's mind. The constable explained that when they reached the crime scene, Bank Chick told them that a dark man, fairly stoutly built and about 5'7" tall, wearing a felt hat pulled down over his face and a handkerchief over his mouth, had shot Pele, who was dead. Mr. Constable couldn't figure out why Bank Chick would say Pele was dead, since they could hear him groaning. However, Mr. Constable said it did not cross his mind to ask the woman why she said the man was dead when he had heard him groaning, nor to ask her how she knew he was dead. All right. Now, I am the first to admit that accidents can happen. And in the heat of the moment, we can appreciate that realizing that the dead man was not in fact dead may have thrown the officers for a loop. This revelation may have stunned the officers on site, causing them to be discombobulated, which resulted in them not asking the most pertinent questions or following all of the correct protocols. But what about the subsequent questioning? Why was it that Bank Chick was escorted to the Sandhurst Apartment Hotel in St. Lawrence Christchurch for the police to record another written statement from her? The excuse that they wanted to be near the scene of the crime, and because there were no adequate facilities at the Oisins police station, seemed a tad questionable. Let's take a look at the Oisins station. Mr. Policeman described Oisins station as a thoroughfare with no privacy. He noted that it was common practice for the police to take witnesses or accused persons to other police stations for statements during investigations of a crime. But Bank Chick wasn't taken to another station. She was taken to Sandhurst Hotel. The reasoning? Because we wanted a place reasonably close to the crime. We wanted to put her at ease. Since she couldn't possibly be a suspect, right? Since she was a friend, and that made her a fine, upstanding citizen. We may never know what prompted the officers to act as they did, but that was only the beginning of the series of highly suspect events that took place. But let's head back to the neighborhood where Pele got shot, because what happens next is where the timeline gets a little iffy. Not too far away from the scene, a concerned citizen heard the gunshots and popped next door to see if his neighbor had heard them too. Mr. Concern's neighbor was entertaining two guests at the time, and none of them had heard the ruckus. They were listening to music. However, a little while later, the house guests, let's call them Mr. and Mrs. Nosey, decided to check it out and head to the area where Mr. Concern had heard the shots. They took a nice slow drive towards the cul-de-sac to see what they could see and noticed that there was not one, not two, but three parked vehicles, of which one certainly, and possibly another, had its headlights on. They saw the registration numbers of the three vehicles, but could only remember two number plates. One was G29, which was Bank Chick's car, where the half-dead Pele currently was. And hello, MC613. If you are like me, You don't remember license plate numbers easily. So let me refresh your memory. MC613 is the red Toyota that Mr. Family Friend and Bike Chick were driving. The third vehicle was, according to the reports, a low-back powerful car, most likely described as powerful because of the speed it took up the hill when it noticed Mr. and Mrs. Nosy approaching. But the low-back powerful car was not the only car to speed away. The four, five, or six, the Nosies weren't sure, people who were standing around all scattered fled the scene too. Not to be outdone, the Nosies followed the two escaping cars, but alas, they lost them. They did, however, get the impression that the powerful car had a driver and a passenger in the front seat, and MC613 had a driver and two passengers. Interesting. So, who did they see? They couldn't be 100% sure, but they believed that there was a woman dressed in shorts. A certain Bank Chick had on shorts, and a woman dressed in slacks. They explained that they thought the person in slacks was a woman because the hair came lower down the neck than a man's hair usually does. Mr. Nosy also had a vague impression that the person who might be a woman in slacks wore spectacles, and that she and the woman in shorts both got into MC613. As the Nosies approached the scene, they saw that the woman in shorts was looking into the vehicle G29 from the driver's window, and that the others were on the right side of that vehicle. All the doors of that vehicle were closed. Let's pause here and recap. If you remember, Mr. Family Friend and Bank Chick turned up at Jay's house after their first visit to the crime scene. Their first visit, during which they claimed they didn't get out. Yet, the Nosies saw people standing around the vehicles, and based on the time, and the fact that they all ran away when they saw someone coming, it wasn't the police. So Bank Chick was possibly spotted at the crime scene in a pair of shorts before she was spotted at Jay's house without said shorts. Mr. Policeman described that Bank Chick was wearing a blue blouse and green toweling shorts. Great that she's no longer parading around in a panty, but let's take a closer look at this one for a moment. Bank Chick went to the family friend's house in her dirty blouse and a panty. She showered there, had her blouse washed and ironed, and then went back to the crime scene before turning up at Jay's house, still clad in a panty. At the commission, Mrs. Family Friend admitted that she gave Bank Chick a pair of toweling shorts and allowed her husband to use her car to take Bank Chick back to the murder scene, which, if we are following the timeline, was before she got to Jay's house. Right? Right. So, why was she still in panties when going to Jay's house after someone who was most likely her was seen at the crime in shorts? Furthermore, as the commission continued, it was revealed that Jay's lady friend noticed the panty was one color, cream, while Mrs. Family Friend noticed a different color, red. Why would she take the shorts off before going to jail? Suspicious, right? But that's not even the most curious thing. There are several more suspicious things about Bankchit's story, which continued to evolve and change, including her boyfriend. You're probably wondering what in the world I'm talking about. Bankchit's boyfriend was shot, and at this point of the story, is finally being raised to the hospital after bleeding out for at least half hour or so in the cul-de-sac. But it would seem that sweet boy Pele was not Bankchit's only boyfriend. Mrs. Family Friend was annoyed as she told the commission that her husband had disobeyed her and allowed Bankchit in the house. Maybe this was why she continued watching the television, who knows? But what we do know is that she decided that she was going to call Bankchit's mother to tell on her. She relayed part of the story to Mumsy, who, immediately concerned, called the responsible man in her daughter's life, the daddy-approved boyfriend. Let's call him L. Now when L got home, he heard that Mumsy had called him. Being a reliable guy, he called her back and got the story that his girl had a little trouble with the police out by Mr. Family Friend. Responsible L said he would head there, but since his car was down, he popped by and got Mumsy's car and both find out what was going on. I just want to be the first to say that no one, not one single person, was giving L a clear picture of what he was heading into. He called Mr. Family Friend, who told him that Bankchit had a little problem with the police, nothing so big. L didn't like the sound of that. He wasn't about the vagueness, but Mr. Family Friend said he didn't want to say over the phone. L got a lift to Mr. Family Friend's house and saw Bankchit in her full uniform, skirt securely on now. He asked her what was wrong, and smart girl that she was, she said she could not tell him and to instead ask Mr. Family Friend. Her reason was that if she told him, she knew he would be vexed with her. But L was already vexed. I let Bankchit know that he had come all the way down there to her and not to Mr. Family Friend. At this point, she proceeded to tell him that she had given a fella a lift to Atlantic Shores to look at land, and they were standing outside the car when another fella came up and shot the man to whom she had given the lift. At this point, L seemed to smell a rat and went back to the car to Bankchit's sister to find out what was really going on. Big Sis asked Bankchit what had happened, and when Bankchit explained, Big Sis asked if it was Pele. L was like, "Who's Pele?" Because suddenly, this fella had a name and was known to the sister. But Bessis caught herself and explained that Pele was a friend of their other sister. L was getting more annoyed, as he should have, although he didn't know it yet. He asked Bankchit what was wrong with the fella, and she explained, rather vaguely, I might add, that the police had taken him to the hospital. He asked her what happened to her car, and she explained that the police told her she couldn't touch it. Never mind that she had already extracted her skirt and handbag from it. In case you are thinking that Elle was a sweetheart, darling, dear heart, knight in shining armor, let me assure you, he wasn't the sweet boy. Earlier that week, without realizing it, Elle met Helly. Here's what happened. According to Mama A, Pele's self-appointed adopted mother, whom he called every day. Elle didn't realize that Bank Chick had another boyfriend, but Pele surely knew about him. He confided to Mama A about a concerning incident that involved said boyfriend. Mama A recounted that Pele called her, as was his custom, and told her,
"I nearly got killed last night,"
and proceeded to describe how Bank Chick's boyfriend intercepted their car, which was coming back from a picnic. Elle pulled his car in front of Bank Chick's to block her, and then removed her ignition keys and drove off. Sometime later, he returned the keys and told Bank Chick the same way she wanted the keys, he wanted her, adding,
"If I don't get you, nobody ain't going to get you."
Mama A reported,
"I told him to see police about it and leave out the Bank Chick. I ain't here for him anymore because he didn't do what I told him."
Mama A said, Bank Chick seemed to switch her story based on who she was talking to, as we can see from the slightly different variation she has spun thus far. But after the initial shock of the incident, she seemed to get her ducks in a row, and the subsequent stories started to sound a little more cohesive, if not rehearsed. Actually, the Assistant Superintendent of Police, ASP, told the commission that Bank Chick was one of the hardest witnesses he had ever met. She never volunteered any information. He said you had to ask her. Under interrogation, ASP said she was a crafty young lady. Later, under questioning, ASP admitted he had a reputation in the Royal Barbados Police Force as being able to crack the toughest witnesses, but conceded he failed with Bank Chick. But by then, she had some time to get her story straight. However, her initial stories have some questionable features, but I'll let you be the judge. She initially told Mr. Policeman at the scene of the crime that a dark man, about 5'7", with a felt hat pulled down over his eyes, white handkerchief across his nose, had attacked them, shot Pele, and ran off with her keys and skirt. She also said she would be able to identify her attacker if seen again, although he wore a hat pulled down over his eyes and a handkerchief across his nose. No one answered how she would have been able to achieve this feat. Then she told another officer that just as they, meaning her and Pele, arrived at Atlantic Shores, a man came up to them holding something bright in his hand and told her to take off her clothes. She said that Pele asked the man why he didn't leave them alone. She asked the would-be attacker if she took off her clothes, whether he would leave them alone. And when he answered yes, she slipped back into the car from the driver's side. She added that Pele was outside and started to unbutton his shirt. As he was unbuttoning his shirt, the man fired 2 shots and Pele fell to the ground. The shooter fled the scene. Bank Chick added that she tried lifting Pele back into the car, but he was too heavy. And that's why she left him and ran and shouted for help. The next day, when giving another statement, she told Inspector C that at the command of the shooter and with the blessing of Pele himself, she unbuttoned her skirt. However, in running around the car to where Pele lay after being shot, the skirt, which she had forgotten to refasten, dropped off. She also mentioned that she'd had $1,100 in possession and it was stolen. Somehow, in the various stories, Pele, who was shot and had fallen to the ground, ended up in the back seat of the car. The skirt, which was stolen by the attacker along with the keys, were somehow returned, which sounded suspiciously like what L did the week in front. There also wasn't any consensus on how many of the car doors were open or closed and at what time. Even more confusing was that the police officers, who should have been the most reliable of witnesses, were giving varying reports on the car doors as well. I don't want to say that the police did a shoddy job, but I don't have to because the coroner, who did the first inquiry, put it much more eloquently.
We in Barbados are accustomed to a high standard of policing, but it is regrettable to state that in many respects, this high standard to which we are accustomed fell to a new low.
We already know about the preferential treatment Bankchik got. But that was the least of the faux pas surrounding the investigation. According to Mr. Policeman, no forensic tests were conducted on Pele's clothing, which was found in the car, or the spot of blood at the scene. A gent's handbag found in the car and said to have belonged to Pele was not listed among exhibits removed from the car. Bankchik's car was released to her about 9 days after the shooting, while investigations were still in progress. Bankchik's handbag was not dusted for fingerprints, nor was it searched. The clothing she wore the night of the shooting was not held by police for forensic tests. To make matters worse, when the police learned that an attempt was made to clean the clothing, remember, Bankchik sure they washed and pressed her blouse by the family friends, and decided that maybe they should check it out, it was too late. They found out that she was so overcome with grief and could not stand the sight of the uniform that she had, burnt them. A little drastic, if you ask me. However, for the first time during the inquiry, it was also revealed that two sets of fingerprints belonging to a person or persons other than Bankchik or Pele were found near the lock of the car trunk and the left front door. Those prints, according to Mr. Policeman, did not match those of criminals on police files. Remember, as far as Mr. Policeman was concerned, Bankchik was not a suspect. Although in my humble opinion, she was looking very suspicious. But anyways, could these two sets of fingerprints back up Bankchik's story? Or at the very least, prove that someone else was at the scene of the crime? Who could that be? Cue the rumors. When Papa Pele had the heartbreaking task of viewing his son's body in the morgue the day after Pele's death, he overheard whispers, the likes of which he had never heard before, surrounding his beloved son. One of the people there mentioned that Pele had said that somebody had threatened his life and had been looking for him with a gun. And in addition to this, a close friend said that Pele had begun showing signs of fear and stress before his death, but had never told him, the friend, what the problem was. Could someone have been after Pele? There's nothing like an unsolved murder of a beloved pillar of the community to stoke the rumor mill. And as you can imagine, stories were spun aplenty. The most salacious of the lot seems to be that a politician was the culprit and there was a massive cover-up. Remember, Pele was a headmaster at an academy for a while. Well, that school sure did belong to Mr. Politician, whom Pele had become fast friends with. Such was his love for the man that he canvassed for him, and by all accounts, was the reason Mr. Politician had won his seat. Pele had also become a member of the party and was at one time secretary of the constituency branch. Pele was an influential guy in the community. Everyone loved and, more importantly, seemed to listen to him, and he had sung the praises of Mr. Politician. In that case, how did we get from love to murder? It may have started with a political activist, let's call him E. It seemed E got to telling people that Mr. Politician had shot Pele, and while a judge shut down that slander with a quickness, people had already started to share the news. Papa Pele, who was of the strong belief that it truly was Mr. Politician who did the deed, said the main dispute between the two was over pay. In addition to being paid only $150 a month while Pele acted as a headmaster of the school, Mr. Politician had also run up arrears on salary payments. That wasn't why Papa Pele was ready to convict Mr. Politician, though. It was what Mr. Politician's wife had to say about the issue. It seems E, the political activist who likely started the entire scandal, had gotten his info from whom he considered a reliable source, Mr. Politician's wife. He then introduced her to Papa Pele to share what she knew. Mrs. Politician met with Papa Pele at the mosque at Robert Street about 3 months after Pele's death and described the gun used to kill him. Papa Pele was sold. He took that information right to the police. However, it seems that the slanderous accusations of an estranged wife did not merit much investigation at the time. Papa Pele shared his experience with the commission.
Do you know if the police interviewed her?
Not to my knowledge.
Were you aware of any relationship between your son and Mrs. Politician?
No.
Have you ever seen them together?
No, that was the first time I knew Mrs. Politician.
Papa Pele explained that while he didn't know the woman before that day, he got the impression from Mrs. Politician's allegation that something had been going on between Pele and Mrs. Politician. He also got the impression that her husband had done the shooting and he had either thrown away the gun after, or that Mrs. Politician knew where the gun was but was not telling him. Something may have prompted Mrs. Politician to backtrack on her story, and Papa Pele told the commissioner that Mrs. Politician approached him later while he was at work with a new tale.
She came there and spoke to me and said she did not tell me the gun was sharp muzzle, but she had heard so. In other words, she denied telling me the gun was sharp muzzle,
Papa Pele said.
Was anyone present at that conversation?
No, sir.
Did you say anything?
I told her she was an intelligent woman and that she was denying these things now because she was getting frightened.
What did she say?
She did not reply.
Papa Pele added that he believed what she told him at the mosque was true and what she was saying when she visited him at work was false.
Is that still your view?
Yes, sir.
Papa Pele felt like he had more evidence to support his claim. He told the commission that there were other facts to support his belief about who had shot and killed his son, in addition to what he had been told at the mosque. He then recounted a scenario and subsequent conversation he himself had with Mr. Politician. About 6 weeks after his son's death, Papa Pele said that a friend called and told him that Mr. Politician had attempted suicide. Guilty conscience, maybe? Papa Pele seemed to think so. And about 5 minutes later, on the same morning, Papa Pele received a telephone call from Mr. Politician.
In these words, he said to me, "Daddy P, forgive me, but there are rumors going around that I killed Pele and then attempted to kill myself."
Papa Pele related. He continued.
I said to him, "Mr. Politician, this is 6 weeks after Pele's death and you now call me. I said you are the MP for this area and you hadn't even tabled a resolution in the House asking why the police is delaying with Pele's case or wouldn't even come back and find out how my family getting on." He started to say that he is the body who sponsored Pele at Baima and caused him to get his job at Welcome Inn.
But Papa Pele had had enough of that convo and put the phone down in his ear. Seemingly, we know who Papa Pele thought the culprit was and why. It also seems that due to the theory that Mr. Politician was a murderer and probably more outrageous claims swirling around, the Prime Minister at the time had to get involved to basically tell people to stop rumor mongering. Plus, to remove any doubt that there was a cover-up, the government held the Commission of Inquiry headed by a Scotland Yard detective, because apparently the police standards were at a new low. But let's tap back to Bang Chick and her changing stories. Well, seeing as suspicion was leading toward Mr. Politician, would you believe that her witness description seemed to morph into a man who looked like Mr. Politician? She even went so far as to say an unnamed man, of course, had told her that he had seen Mr. Politician's vehicle in the area around the time of Pele's shooting. Convenient, to say the least. It seems that Banchet had been planning a trip before the murder. While she was so distressed that she had to burn her uniform, she wasn't distressed enough to cancel her flight and was headed to the airport as scheduled. However, the police were like, "Nah." So that departure was postponed. Some say the police actually stopped her from boarding the plane. However, seeing as the commission took almost 2 years to materialize, Bankchick surely did take her trip, actually relocated to New York, and had absolutely no interest in returning. Couldn't the powers that be make her come home, you ask? Well, technically, since she wasn't officially charged with anything, they had no grounds to force her to come back. It would be up to their diplomatic persuasiveness, which really didn't matter to Bank Chick, who was quite content never to return to Barbados. It stands to reason that Bank Chick would not willingly come back, especially when after the first inquiry, the coroner stated,
"This court has found it extremely difficult to believe the evidence of some of the more important witnesses, and in particular, Bank Chick, who it would appear finds it extremely difficult to tell the truth."
But the judge wasn't the only one who thought Bank Chick was lame. So did her dear old dad. Granted, her dad didn't have anything to say about the murder or her part played in it, but he didn't for 1 minute think Bank Chick was looking for land in the middle of the night at a known lover's spot, as he said as much. Mr. Policeman said he had spoken to dear old dad at the Oisins police station just after he had completed recording the first statement from Bank Chick.
"I told him his daughter was out there with a man, that the man was shot, and that Bank Chick had mentioned she was out there with a man looking at land."
Mr. Policeman told the commission that dear old dad, a retired police officer, replied,
"Man, I don't believe her. She was looking for no line. Speaking to you man to man, she went out there and she needs a word."
Mr. Policeman said,
That means having sex.
In the end, Bank Chick did admit that she had a sexual relationship with Pele, but that was the only admission she gave. Just to cover all our bases, it was a random car heading away from the crime scene when Good Samaritan first saw Bank Chick, and maybe this unknown car was a killer speeding away. But that story is highly unlikely. The commission came to the same conclusion. The killer was unlikely to be in that random car. So who really killed Pele? It was very possible that Pele may have named his shooter while at the hospital. However, the nurses and doctors were not interviewed, nor was a dying confession taken. There's been a lot of speculation on if Pele was lucid enough to tell someone who had shot him, or if he was speaking, but out of his mind due to blood loss and, well, being shot. In addition, one of the doctors recalled hearing Pele repeat several times in the recovery room something about his foot or shoes. A nurse noted that Pele, who was already barefooted, was saying something to the effect that he wanted his shoes off and placed in the back seat with him. The head doctor explained that it is a normal practice in a case of sudden death for the police to contact the doctor in charge to try to ascertain the cause of death. It was also normal to make notes on any observation on the injury that the doctor may have stated and to obtain a certificate certifying death. In that case of Pele, the senior doctor in charge and the one who certified his death were not approached by the police for those purposes. This fact is starting to lend support to the view that some of the police officers were covering for Bank Chick. Whether she asked them to or not is another story. Whether Pele named his killer or not, there was no record to say who it was. The million-dollar question was who killed Pele. And based on the evidence and general shadiness, the commission believed that Bank Chick did it, or knew who did, and that Mr. and Mrs. Family Friend, Mr. Policeman, and some other officers conspired to help her conceal the facts. The magistrate in the initial coroner's inquiry noted,
"This court has found it extremely difficult to believe the evidence of some of the more important witnesses, and in particular, Bank Chick, who it would appear finds it extremely difficult to tell the truth."
The commission's report, on the other hand, was a tad more direct and fingered Bank Chick as the killer, even mentioning that several people, including Mr. Policeman, had conspired to pervert the course of justice. These were just two, but rather major, of the findings of the Commission of Inquiry into Unsolved Murders. Let's see what that 231-page report, which cost the government $183,000, had to say. 1. Pele was shot outside of the car. 2. Upon being shot, he fell to the ground. 3. He was paralyzed in the lower limbs by the bullet and so could not have moved himself from where he fell. 4. He could not have been moved by Bank Chick from where he fell before she left the scene in the car of Good Samaritan, unless he was lifted into the car by a random unknown person before Family Friend returned to the scene with Bank Chick. Mr. Family Friend could not have seen Pele's legs extending from the right rear door of the car G29, Bank Chick's car. This means, unless there was a random do-gooder lifting half-dead strangers and making them more comfortable in cars, Mr. Family Friend and Bank Chick were lying. Other facts that show there were definite tampering with the scene are the varying accounts from Good Samaritan, who would have been the first person to see the scene outside of Bank Chick. His perspective was different from Mr. and Mrs. Nosey, the couple who were by a neighbor nearby and went to investigate, who likely saw the first visit of Bank Chick and Mr. Family Friend before the police came. Here's what we know. 1. Good Samaritan noticed that at least two doors of G29 were open, while the Nosies noticed that all four doors were closed. 2. Pele was on the ground when Bank Chick left the scene with Good Samaritan, but when the Nosies arrived, no one was lying on the ground. 3. There's also the evidence of a nurse who shortly before he died said she heard Pele request the removal of his shoes and assistance to help him sit up. A request that suggests Pele was reliving a previous incident. Now here's the thing. After all that time, effort, and investigation, nothing happened. The Director of Public Prosecution, in a letter to the Attorney General, dated September 9th, 1980, stated that on the evidence available, such prosecutions will not be instituted. The DPP felt that the evidence was insufficient to justify charging Bank Chick. However, it seems that the Commissioner of Police, with the advice of the Solicitor General, did formulate charges against policemen and two others. Plus, the Commissioner of Police had already been directed by the Attorney General to implement at the earliest opportunity the recommendations for improving the investigative procedures of the force. What's more, it seems that the DPP stated that Pele's case will be kept open and that the Commissioner of Police had been working with him with a view of securing additional evidence to assist in any further action which might become necessary on any other available evidence. So you're probably wondering what Bank Chick had to say about all of this. Well, remember she had gone to New York and stayed there and was living her best life. It was seen working at a bank on Wall Street. However, a reporter of the Nation newspaper tracked her down. Bank Chick, as you could imagine, did not want to speak to a reporter, or anyone else for that matter, on the commission's finding. However, she did say one thing before calling her lawyer and directing further questions to him.
It is not the way people think it is. One day, I will return to Barbados and clear my name.
But at this time, their hearts, it seems that someday hasn't come yet. Hear you next time, Miss Levy find out.
Tales from the Archives. Who Killed Pele? Volume 1. Written by Shara Spencer. Narration by Diara Springer. Produced by Adrian Boeing. Tales from the Archives. Who Killed Pele? From the ebook series produced by The Nation Publishing Company Limited.